The CNBC app. Global market news in one place. Customizable sections and personalized alerts. Stocks tracking, interactive charts and market insights all in your hands. Stay connected. Stay informed. Download the CNBC app today.
Democrats prepared to move forward with articles of impeachment against President Trump, potentially making him the only president in history to suffer the same fate twice. U.S. equities are look poised to retreat from their record levels, with futures pointing lower and the 10-year Treasury yield breaking through 1.1% despite a disappointing jobs report, with December payrolls falling. Top U.S. banks are set to delist over 500 structured Hong Kong products, pointing to broader fallout from the White House ban on companies with ties to the Chinese military. And global coronavirus cases surge, with China seeing its biggest daily increase since July and the U.S. hitting a record number of cases, while U.K. health officials warn of a strained health system.
The NHS needs you now more than it's needed anyone at any point, and what it needs people to do is to stay at home.
And Daimler says it expects the pandemic to hit demand in the first half of this year. But the CEO tells CNBC in an exclusive interview that the German car maker still hopes to deliver an increase in annual sales.
We have to calculate with the first 6 months of this year still having some disruption here and there, and we have to be flexible and deal with those things. But the underlying demand that we felt coming back in the second half of 2020, that underlying demand, we see that also in 2021.
Right, a very warm welcome to the show with Karen, Jeff and myself. Of course, a huge number of big stories around the world, and the COVID story, as Karen was mentioning in the headlines, absolutely front and foremost. But the events in the United States of the last week or so mean that we're going to start off the show with that as well, because let's face it as well, the events surrounding Mr. Trump as well are quite extraordinary, unprecedented and historical. So let's just go through what's happening as well. Democrats are now pushing to remove the president from office after last week's deadly assault on the US Capitol. Don't forget, of course, the president's only got, what are we today, the 11th? He's only actually got 9 days left before the inauguration. An inauguration, by the way, that he won't be attending. And just for historical precedence, and so you know, he's not the first US president or the second or the third to actually not attend an inauguration. John Adams, John Quincy Adams, and Andrew Jackson as well did not attend the presidential inauguration for the person who was succeeding them as well. So Nancy Pelosi now says the House will first vote to push Vice President Mike Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment. If he does not, the House will then proceed from this, the 25th Amendment, to perhaps a second impeachment trial. Now, speaking basically, it makes Mr. Trump the only president to be impeached twice as well. And you know the problems here. The problem is, of course, the fact that it's such a tight time frame. But here's something very interesting as well that you need to be aware of. You can impeach Mr. Trump after the inauguration of Mr. Biden. And of course, one thing that President-elect Biden doesn't want is that his early stages of his first term to be dominated by events surrounding Mr. Trump. So this is a political calculation on both sides of the divide. Senator Pat Toomey has joined a handful of other Republicans, meanwhile, in calling for the president's resignation. But in an interview with NBC's Meet the Press, Mr. Toomey said there wasn't enough time for Congress to impeach Trump before he leaves office.
The president spiraled down into a kind of madness that was different. I'm sorry if people don't acknowledge that. I think what he did this past week is wildly different from the offensive tweets that were common during his presidency. And I don't think that those tweets clearly indicated that this was coming.
There's an extraordinary situation where people who have, and we'll use the word that's the word du jour, enabled Mr. Trump for so long to carry out his position and carry out his way of doing business in the Republican Party and indeed in the administration as well. So many of those people now are standing by and saying, well, actually, we disagree with Mr. Trump right at the last moment, including the White House former chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, who resigned, last week. He says the president has now crossed the line he never crossed before.
Wednesday was a fundamental threat to the United States. It speaks to what's, what makes us American. It's an existential type of thing. It's not superficial. It's deep and it's real and it's different, which is why you saw so many resignations this week and didn't see them over the course of the last couple of years. Wednesday changed everything.
So let me bring in Jeff here as well, because Jeff, I've got a question, and I just saw a little bit of news early this morning, late last night, which I think was quite interesting. So my question for the audience is, what hurts President Trump the most? What is really hurting him at the moment? One, losing the election. Two, losing access to his 89 million followers on Twitter. Or three, and I wonder if this is up there as well, the PGA now turning around and saying, no, we're not going to use your Bedminster course anymore, Mr. Trump. We don't want our brand associated with you, because the PGA was going to be held there in 2022. Good morning to you, my friend.
Yeah, very good morning to you. Well, given how desperately President Trump seems to need positive reaffirmation, I suspect that the PGA may be the issue that is front and center for him this morning. I think Twitter, we can deal with that one in a minute. I think Twitter and the other social platforms that are talking about permanently banning him or suspending his accounts have got a whole lot of other troubles to deal with, because I think that raises all sorts of issues about the role of these social media platforms and whether they should be allowed to turn off people, however loathsome. But we'll set that aside for the moment, because I do think that the PGA issue will be the one that the president is smarting most about this morning. Because, of course, if there is one thing that President Trump wants at this stage, that is a life after the presidency. And I know there's been a lot of speculation that he may have a television channel planned or some other platform for him to express himself. But if increasingly brand Trump is seen as toxic and other parties are unwilling to do business deals with him or work with his organization, then I think that will be perceived by him and those around him as very difficult going forward.
Yeah, I think there's a huge amount to discuss about. I mean, again, there was lots of reason. Karen, you're our person who looks more at these things than perhaps Jeff and I have done historically as well. But they've taken the advantages of the Trump administration for 4 years plus the social media sites, haven't they? They've done incredibly well out of it as well, with the advertising associated with the huge explosion of activity surrounding Mr. Trump and indeed his style of doing politics as well. Again, it does seem to have come incredibly late in the game that they've decided that he's finally crossed the line.
Right. I mean, the condemnation is pretty universal when you consider what happened last week on Capitol Hill. But if you rewind a little bit further, the much stronger language from the social media companies really started just before the US election. You saw that very ramped up focus on the sharing of certain type of speech and making sure that the statements from politicians were correct, that those statements were actually founded on legitimate purposes and not false news, fake news being spread. So I think there's been a trend. That said, I mean, what you're now seeing, opportunism from other social media platforms trying to get ahead, where you've seen the closure of certain sites.
So, you make a really interesting point, and you talk about others now. But one thing that's, and again, we're actually breaking up the rundown a little bit here, but we'll get back to JP Morgan in a second, Jeff. But I think it's very interesting. We've talked a lot about the dominance of these four or five technological behemoths that are out there as well. Your Google, your Amazon, your Apple, your Twitter, your Facebook as well. Now, let's take this to its natural conclusion. Are these smaller sites that, again, the alt-right and QAnon are now being forced to migrate to, will they be able to pick up traction in the way that other tech companies cannot compete with those five behemoths we just mentioned as
well? Why not? You saw it in the mainstream press. You saw channels that have come out of nowhere that have become mainstream news channels. And they serve a particular side of politics. Why isn't that the same with social media?
I'll tell you why. One reason why the scale matters, and of course, is because the advertisers, of course, have been at loggerheads with the likes of Facebook and Twitter at various stages this year. But especially Facebook, let's be honest. I think that advertisers are going to be very loath to associate themselves with niche sites that perhaps appeal to a certain demographic, which they don't want their brand in the round.
That's a good point about international advertisers. But I'm sure that some advertisers will want to target that demographic too.
I don't know which advertisers.
Not global international companies, but I'm sure there might be some domestic ones located in particular jurisdictions that think that some of those supporters, very far right-wing supporters, might in fact be their customers too.
We've been at the desk 9 minutes, and I'm going to beg to differ, but we'll send this one back to Jeff as well, because it's our first beg to differ this year. Jeff.
Okay. Well, we made it all the way through till what, Monday, the 11th of January. So little pat on the back for everybody around the desk. Look, I mean, the whole issue of to platform or no platform is going to be with us for some time to come, I think. And we're going to have to get into this over coming programs, because I think there's a whole lot here away from President Trump that we do need to address about the flow of information and the accuracy of information. I think like a lot of people lean towards that more liberal interpretation that I think Voltaire laid down about you should have the right to say something, however unpalatable it does seem. And I think when it comes to the First Amendment, that's pretty much laid out in the American Constitution. So what Twitter does here, I think, will be watched very closely. Twitter has banned President Trump for life. The social media giant says that after reviewing the president's recent tweets, it took the move to, quote, reduce the risk of further incitement of violence. Many platforms have banned or restricted the president's accounts, including Facebook and Instagram, where he's banned for at least the next 2 weeks. I think we've done pretty good service on this. So let me move on and talk about this banking story, which I think, again, is going to be very significant in the broader picture of US-China relations. JP Morgan Chase and Citigroup have announced a halt to political donations following last week's riot at the U.S. Capitol building. In a statement, J.P. Morgan said contributions to both the Republican and Democratic parties will be paused for at least 6 months. Meanwhile, Citigroup also told employees it will not send money to any lawmaker in the first quarter and vowed not to back candidates who did not support the rule of law. And of course, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit here. There's another story we're going to focus on, which deals with the withdrawal of structured products from the Hong Kong market by US banks. Just another area where business is being drawn into political issues. And I'm sure a lot of these executives feel very uncomfortable about that, Steve.
Yeah, brilliant stuff, Jeff. Thank you. Okay, look, the US economy saw its first monthly job losses since April, with the non-farm payrolls falling by 140,000 in December. Now, that was well below the expectations for a gain of 50,000. Virus-sensitive industries such as hospitality continued to be the worst hit due to widespread restrictions. The unemployment rate remained pretty steady, unfortunately stubbornly high at 6.7%, in line with expectations. But these markets, Karen, have been absolutely fascinating. Their gravity-defying pull, perhaps not gravity-defying, perhaps it's entirely logical why they are where they are.
It's a reflation trade on stimulus, isn't it? Even bad news is good news that we saw in that payrolls report, and the market is primed for fresh stimulus conversations this week from President-elect Biden. They're eyeing the potential for $2,000 stimulus checks and $3 trillion infrastructure spending package. And you've seen that bounce as a result right across the board. Fresh records eked out for the Dow, the S&P and NASDAQ in session. And take a look at that level we're now perched on the Dow. 31,000 plus is what we're watching. It took just 29 trading days to climb to this level. And banks, energy firms, a big part of that mix. But you can see Friday's session, technology names also a key contributor, playing some of those green themes. Tesla in the electric vehicle space showing its dominance now, part of the S&P 500. It was the top mover for the S&P and also for the NASDAQ. That is a play into what the Biden administration may do on the clean energy side. So that was a big mover. But right across the board, you can see a bounce. Some of this inspired by what you're seeing on treasuries as well. Let's take a look at that market as we talk about a reflation trade. Very classic to see also yields marching north, and we breached the 1.10% mark. You can see 1.11 is what we've got on that US 10-year yield. So there's been an aggressive push to this 10-month top that you're seeing on those yields. A quick look at what we've got on US futures as we get set up for the trading day today. It was a strong march north last week, as you can see. And as a result, futures this morning have just been a little bit softer. You can see red flashing up on the boards at this day. It's also the start of earnings season, and there are some concerns about how far we've risen on markets now, the entry point for a lot of investors, and what this earnings season now needs to produce. A quick look at what we're seeing on the European markets early on. It was a stunning pace for the FTSE in particular last week, which looks a little bit flat this morning, as you can see, but the gains are strong, more than 6% to the upside, well and truly outpacing what you saw across on some of the other major markets, more in the range of about 2.5%, for instance, for the DAX. So we're looking a little bit weak at the start of the session early on this morning. You can see red arrows marching onto those European markets. Jeff.
Okay, Karen, thank you. Let's take a quick break here. We'll be back in just a moment. A trio of top US banks have decided to delist hundreds of structured products from the Hong Kong market as they respond to the direction from the US president to disengage from Hong Kong. We'll have more on that story in a moment.
And for more on potential impeachment proceedings against President Trump, don't forget to check out the Squawk Box podcast.
Ambition to me is about doing better.
I think ambition creates a pathway.
The best advice I can give someone starting off a career is don't have a career, have lots of careers, try loads of different things.
Talk to people and put your ambition out there.
I don't feel that I've hit peak ambition because it's a learning journey.
CNBC is where ambition meets opportunity. What does living ambitiously mean to you? Hear it from our CNBC anchors, reporters, and global business leaders on CNBC.com.
Welcome back, everybody. Let's focus on this story centered around Hong Kong then. Three key US banks, Morgan Stanley, JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs, have issued filings with the Hong Kong Stock Exchange to delist 500 structured products after a US crackdown on telecom companies linked to the Chinese military. Let's get out to Emily in Hong Kong, who can tell us a little bit more about what these products are and what this will mean for investors who may own them. Emily, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Jeff. And of course, these moves by the U.S. banks, similar to brokerages here in Hong Kong, spoke to some traders, similar moves where they can't deal in the affected sanctioned stocks. So the likes of China Mobile, China Unicom, as well as CNOOC, in fears that that could be affecting any business that they want to do with the United States. Maybe it could be they could sell the stock for U.S. investors, but some banks have even decided that they're not going to deal with it at all. They're just not going to touch it. But we're seeing really big gains come through here in China Mobile shares in Hong Kong trade today, up about 6.5%. China Unicom floating around with a 6% gain as well. As you all know, Chinese telcos, they're going to be delisted from the New York Stock Exchange come 5 p.m. Hong Kong time. So that's just about 2.5 hours from now. We got ADRs, the executive order, on these companies like China Unicom, China Mobile, CNOOC, effective from 10:30 p.m. Hong Kong time, and that's 9:30 a.m. U.S. time. On the back of that, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, JP Morgan delisting something like 500 Hong Kong listed structured products. And we found this out because they made a filing to the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. The exchange saying that they're working closely with relevant issuers to ensure orderly delisting and facilitate buyback arrangements arranged by the issuers. Goldman Sachs suspended all trading in Hang Seng Index callable bull bear contracts and delisted them. The likes of Mobile and CNOOC are on the U.S. sanctions sanctions list and Hang Seng components as well. So we also saw a move by the Tracker Fund here in Hong Kong. That's 2800.hk, saying that they're not going to be making any new investments in these sanctioned companies, and it is no longer appropriate for U.S. funds to be investing in that. So this is all in response to the moves by the Trump administration to target these Chinese-linked military companies. And then all of this has already been announced in terms of these deadlines that's going to be today. So we're seeing all the response, the FTSE Russell, the MSCI, S&P, saying that they're going to be, of course, pulling out of all of these stocks, removing it from their benchmark indices, and the likes of all these banks making similar moves to make sure that they don't infringe on any of these U.S. rules or the restrictions that have been imposed. But the market here having a bounce back. Of course, all of this news was coming through last week, the delisting and then on and off again. The market here is very strong today. In Hong Kong, we're at about a one-year high, 27,884, and all the telco stocks today rebounding from the big losses that we had last week. Now, in a separate story, also due to do with the United States and maybe rubbing China the wrong way, is this development in the Taiwan relations. Taiwan presidential office hailing the U.S. decision to lift restrictions on contact between officials of the two sides, the counterparts between Taiwan and the United States. Taiwan saying that this is a reflection of a solid partnership. This is in response to Pompeo and his bid to regularize interactions between the two sides. Taiwan thanks the U.S. State Department and all Americans' longstanding support, helping to facilitate the current close and friendly bilateral relation, saying that Taiwan is going to be continuing to seek a deeper cooperation with the United States. And this does come as the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. is scheduled for a trip to Taiwan, and there will be a meeting with President Tsai Ing-wen there when it happens, January 13th to 15th. So just happening in a couple days from now this week. Back to you guys in London.
Yeah, Emily, call me old-fashioned and call me skeptical, but I can't help thinking the timing. Just what is it now? 9 days before the inauguration, Mr. Pompeo tightening links with Taiwan. That's very interesting what it leaves as a legacy in terms of the relationship between Joe Biden's administration and China. Talking of China, China's factory prices fell at their slowest pace in 10 months in December as China's manufacturing sector continues to recover from the pandemic. The producer price index fell by 0.4% on the year, which was less than expected, whilst consumer prices returned to growth after an unexpected fall in November. Quick look at these Asian markets for you and where we are currently trading. The Hang Seng, 0.15% to the good. Negative moves we're seeing on the Shanghai Composite by the tune of 1% as well. And a pretty flat KOSPI, which, again, the KOSPI has been the outstanding performer on global markets so far this year. Jeffrey.
Let's bring in Freya Beamish then, Chief Asia Economist for Pantheon Macroeconomics. Freya, one of the features of the pickup in activity in China has been the strong supply side response, but the sluggishness we've seen around demand. Are we going to see in the early part of this year a shift in that softness in the services data?
Yeah, I think in the services inflation data, certainly we're expecting a kind of a step change. It's looking very kind of detached in China. The services inflation is looking very detached from the kind of the underlying short-term indicators even that we have. So your kind of your price indices of the PMIs and even the wage data, such as it is in China. It's not great data, but it is actually showing pointing to an imminent step change in services inflation. So we can expect a strong pickup there. That doesn't tell us much on the global scale because it's kind of different. Obviously, services are much more disjointed on the global scale. But it's a kind of a microcosm of the wider global picture for services, where you do have this huge pile of cash against what is probably a diminished services supply side. You've talked about the supply side economy leading in terms of China's recovery, but the supply side in terms of services and the firms that are able to cater to this demand globally and within China are probably have taken such a great hit, and yet there's going to be this release of pent up demand. With those cash balances in the household sector, so we are expecting a big step change in China, and it probably is. It's going to be even bigger in the rest of the world.
Freya, is there any risk to that rebound in domestic demand from this very modest pickup we see in COVID cases in China? It's a little more than 100 new cases that have been reported in Hebei province, but that represents the highest number of new cases we've seen in China since July. And we know that the authorities respond very aggressively and very dramatically to these new cases. Will there be any risk, do you think, to that domestic demand-led recovery?
It looks very small compared to developed markets, but in China, they take things much more seriously at an earlier stage, and that's paid dividends for them previously. So I'm expecting them to crack down quickly. It is the smallest it is a small outbreak. It's the biggest that we've seen, I think, in 5 months. And the restrictions that are already in place in Hebei province, which surrounds Beijing, which is another element of concern for the authorities. The restrictions that we've seen there already have had an impact, possibly on the travel within Beijing. Looking at the metro numbers, so with the Lunar New Year coming up, it's almost like a rerun of last year that the authorities are more likely to do more than they need to rather than less than they need to. So we could see a bit of damage in the short term, but it's all a waiting game at this stage. And going back to our favorite leading indicator of M1 growth in China, and including household deposits as well, that tells us quite clearly that Chinese GDP growth should be accelerating through this year, up to almost twice the quarter on quarter run rate that we're seeing at the moment by the end of this year compared with the beginning of it. So there could be some nasty volatility at the beginning of the year, but that just means there'll be more pent up demand released at the end of the year. And taking that back to where we started on prices, that probably feeds through the M1 trends, probably feed through to commodity prices, of rising levels of commodity prices this year back to around 2014 levels, and right, continuing to rise in next year to 2011 type, right, of levels. Freya, so we can expect that to continue rising just based on those M1 trends.
So Freya, if we piece together the different factors here around commodity prices to the industrial recovery, pent-up demand that you're witnessing on the domestic front, where does that leave monetary policy? Because a couple of analysts think that there might be room now for the PBOC to think about unwinding some of this extraordinary stimulus. Yet if you think of where other central banks are at, it's obviously a difficult equation to start unwinding if others are still providing support. What levers do you think that the central bank will pull this year?
I think I would be definitely in the camp where of China front running that tightening cycle that has to come globally at some stage. But China's recovery has front run the global recovery, and as a result of that, we have seen this natural updrift in short term sovereign yields. That in itself will put some brake on the uptrend in M1. And the liquidity that's available to the economy, but I would expect the PBOC to get in there and validate that in the second half of this year through interest rate rises. Now that's slightly at odds with their aims on the renminbi. We've already seen them getting uncomfortable with the strength of the renminbi. With the daily fixing, we can see them pulling against the market, which is not something that they often do. So it's a clear signal that they're uncomfortable with the strength of the RMB already, and also the FX reserves data that came out recently. That was suggesting that they're pushing against that appreciation pressure. I think ultimately, though, the COVID dominates the RMB in the short run. But the PBOC, they'll be worried about the RMB, but they'll be much more focused on the domestic demand situation and the trends that we see in money growth, and what that implies for the property market and their longer term goals trying to keep a rein on that debt build up.
Freya, the producers have given me, in their wisdom, 30 seconds to ask you a question, so I will. Where's the first point of tension going to be between the Biden administration and China, given the fact that you're an economist and not a geopolitical strategist? I'm sure even you can answer that one, though.
well, these problems are not going to go away between China and the US. It's kind of classic kind of Thucydides trap of the two massive giants of the global stage. That said, I'm hoping that Biden will be less volatile. That's not a very high bar, but we're hoping that he will be less volatile and there won't be so much of the kind of the pointless attacks between the two nations. He can't step back completely. That kind of boat has sailed. China, you can't be a China dove anymore. You have to be tough on China. So we're not expecting these problems to go away in any sense of the word. But we are expecting hopefully some smoother sailing. Although it's not that difficult to be smoother sailing than the relationship between Trump and Xi Jinping.
Thank you for listening to Squawk Box Europe Express.
For more market-moving news, you can head to CNBC.com.
Or join us again on the show with Jeff Cutmore, Steve Sedgwick and Karen Cho, weekdays on CNBC.